You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, Robert.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for joining the program, the Business of Pharmacy podcast. Where is our crossover between the cool stuff you do and the business of pharmacy?
I'm director of product management at a startup software company called Montuno Software, which has been around since 2010. The company was originally started by some software engineers that affiliated with MIT, Google, at different parts of their career. And the company actually was founded around a mobile application that helps patients manage their medications. It's a pharmacy medication reminder app. It's called DoseCast. It's available on all the app stores. And really what they were attempting to go out to solve was making the management for patients, managing their complex medication regimens easier. So patients that take 3+ medications throughout the day, it's difficult for them to remember. And so the app is more flexible for them to be able to schedule their medications. And it does push notifications. It works with Apple Watches. It really solves that, 40% of the issue of medication non-adherence being forgetfulness. So it really helps with that. And then it logs all the history. So when patients take their drugs on time, if they were late, they can add a little bit of subjective health and some symptom information as well when they take their medications. And so it creates a nice log that can then be emailed, shared with family members and doctors. So that's kind of the core, consumer application. And that's why I thought this would be a good fit. So the digital health space is trying to really solve for a lot of the problems around pharmacy and the healthcare system in general. And we know that, pharmacy is a key, area for treating any chronic conditions, which make up 75% of the U.S. healthcare costs. So, that's why I thought we had a pretty good fit to have a conversation.
Give me that number you mentioned in 40% non-compliance, would you say? Define that. What does that mean?
This is coming from a large systematic review of a lot of studies of non-adherence, non-compliance for patients with their treatment regimens and their medication non-adherence. They found that about 40% of non-adherence cases are related to forgetfulness. So patients just simply forgetting to take their medications.
And so non-adherence, that would be like defined as, like, let's say you're supposed to take a tablet 30 days in a row. If you don't do that every day, then you're non-adherent.
Right.
And 40% of the prescriptions would fall into that category of not taking it the way the doctor ordered it.
Right. So let's put it this way. So generally, the number that's thrown around in the academic literature is about 50% of patients are non-adherent to their treatment medication in
Gotcha.
General. So if you were to have 10 patients in a coffee shop and you pulled out five of them, those are the ones that are likely to be, that's how many are likely to be non-adherent to their or non-compliant to their treatment regimen.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of reasons why that happens. A lot
Gotcha.
Of times it can be distrust of the medical system. It can be cost-related issues. It can be forgetfulness. So 40% of those of the wide variety of issues that cause patients to be non-compliant is linked to sort of just forgetting. So going about one's daily routine and just not remembering to take a medication.
So 40% of the 50% is forgetfulness or just not doing it.
Yep. Yep.
Wow. That's huge. I think I was talking to a veterinarian or somebody on animals, and they said it's a lot better with animals. People mm-hmm. don't want to forget their animals taking the medicine, but... But with humans, it's like, a third don't even get it filled. And then like you're saying half don't. So it's a huge, huge number.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, when we think about things like hot topics in health policy are the social determinants of health. A couple of those are access to transportation or, for people who have low income, not being able to afford medication and not being able to actually get to a pharmacy to pick up their medication
yeah.
is a major barrier. So those are also barriers to medication non-adherence from the system's perspective. But again, the general number that I've seen is about 40% is non-adherence. Is forgetfulness, I should say.
Right.
And that's where we kind of fit in with the mobile app from the start. Now we're definitely moving towards more of a chronic disease management application, so centered around pharmacy, centered around medications, but also providing diagnostic information. So when patients have a blood glucose meter at home, they can enter their blood glucose on a daily basis with their medications. And then it all goes into that nice report that's available to physicians to be able to sort of remotely manage patients in real time. So that's where we're moving towards. But we kind of came from this forgetfulness, helping patients just remember, manage, know when refills are up, kind of everything about their medications on their smartphone.
Right. All right. So, Robert, we're going to get back to that. We got to back up here. Your LinkedIn is a really interesting journey that I went through, and a few things I got to talk to you about. We got to get down to business here.
All right.
Washington, D.C. Are you there? I know you went to college around there and you live there. Are you there for a political reason or in order to make changes with the government and so on, or is that just you ended up there or you grew up there?
Yeah, so I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Your accent's gone if you had one.
Yeah, so my parents are from Delaware, so I have that really mid-Atlantic, no accent.
Yeah.
But I went to Wake Forest University for my first year of undergrad, and
which is where?
It's in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Yep. I wanted to go to medical school. I was, studying pre-med there. I was taking all the chemistry, biochem, all those classes. But halfway through that time, I got really interested in the sort of larger healthcare system. So I decided to transfer to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. to study healthcare management and policy. That's kind of how I ended up here. I worked in a couple healthcare organizations, both research and policy and delivery system managed care related during my time in D.C. And I got offered this job with this digital health tech startup. So I'm here for the reason of that's where the company is.
Let's say this company could move anywhere it could. You think Washington's a good fit, or would you be in, Silicon Valley or something like that? Or you think Washington's a good fit for medical slash tech, so on?
Yeah, so, typically San Francisco, Silicon Valley, those are the hotspots for digital health innovation right now, and generally any tech startups. That's where the capital's located. That's where a lot of the talent's located.
Yeah.
DC has a growing startup scene, a growing tech scene. Amazon's headquarters is moving out here to Northern Virginia, and there's a lot of cloud-based computing centers out here to service the federal government. So there's a lot of talent in DC, actually. So the startup scene, particularly in healthcare as well, is growing substantially. So when you think about it, New York, San Francisco, Silicon Valley are typically the places that you see these types of startups popping up. And Boston as well is sort of the healthcare mecca in the United States, if you will. In DC, there's a lot of, it's where all the federal health programs are administered typically. So Medicare and Medicaid, most of the policy and a lot of the funding allocations are here. Any federal grants for research and development are located here at National Institutes of Health. Like I said, there's a growing tech talent in Northern Virginia. A lot of government contractors. So, it's actually a growing space for government tech and health tech companies as well, taking advantage of a lot of the large organizations that they sell to. So all the major health insurance companies, all the major pharmaceutical companies have a presence in D.C. for political reasons and for policy reasons. But that gives you access to a lot of the sort of national level leaders as well.
Yeah, right.
So it's a good place to be. There's a lot of conferences here, a lot of healthcare conferences.
Now, you mentioned Amazon. They built they're doing some headquarters, you said, they're a tech thing, or?
If you keep on top of Amazon news for about a year and a half or so, they had this big, we're searching for our HQ2.
Yeah, Grand Rapids was one of them. At least people said they were in the running.
Yeah, there were a lot of them. So Atlanta was in the running for a while. People were expecting Atlanta to be up there. But they really came down. They made the decision they were going to split it between New York City and Northern Virginia, Crystal City, Northern Virginia. New York, if you remember, AOC, who was recently elected into
she
Congress.
She said, we don't want you.
Yeah, she said she said she doesn't want them. It became sort of a political, I want to say, firestorm for Amazon. And they decided to not go to New York City and move the whole HQ2 to Northern Virginia. So Amazon is currently recruiting pretty heavily in the area. And they already have a presence here. They have had one here for a while in some of Northern Virginia because they do have some of their cloud headquarters there, their cloud centers, their big data centers.
You guys are trying to find out if you can cast absentee ballots from Virginia for AOC to do her part for you in New York still.
Yeah. We're definitely you know, glad that that's happening from our business perspective.
Yeah. They'll be on the two coasts then. Amazon will.
They'll have Northern Virginia and I guess they're in Seattle.
Seattle, I think they are. Yeah. 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 Take me through your couple college degrees then, Robert. So you had two bachelor's, I think. Is that correct?
I only have one. So you have one, I went to Wake Forest for a year.
Yep. Wake Forest.
Yep.
And then you went to George Washington.
Georgetown.
Oh, Georgetown. Georgetown. Yep. Yep. Where's Georgetown then? I forget.
Georgetown is in Washington, D.C. We're like, I don't know, about a mile from George Washington University. But Georgetown is, you know, home to, you know, basketball in the 80s it was really good and not so great since then. Patrick Ewing is now our he's our new basketball coach actually, so he came back to Georgetown. Bill Clinton is a Georgetown graduate. So that's kind of a summary there.
Yeah, Ewing was kind of from my, I think he was mid, I don't know, was he mid-80s or something when he played? Or seems to be about when I graduated from high school back then.
So he was, I believe the 80s he was there. It was a big rivalry. You know, Georgetown was playing really good basketball. It was Georgetown, St. John's University, and Marquette, and all those schools back when that was a big heyday for that conference for basketball. I'm not a big basketball person, so I'm kind of stumbling over my words here. But
I always says when in the pharmacy, it'd be, I don't know, maybe before the internet. I guess this is like 10 years ago. Before I would go work in the pharmacy, I'd have to ask one of my sons to give me like a 1 minute rundown on the sports going on that day, just so when people came in, I knew I was in the right season at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely have had some situations like that before. I'm definitely a tried and true healthcare system, health policy, nerd, if you will. So that's what I studied at Georgetown. I graduated with a degree in healthcare management and policy.
Healthcare management and policy. So that's taking the step. Some people might not like the word above, but it's taking a step beyond the practitioners into managing what they're doing and so on.
Yep, absolutely.
When you went into that program, what was either your dream or your knowledge of what you'd be doing 5 or 10 years out from graduating? What were your thoughts at that time?
When I first got there and started studying that, I still wanted to go to medical school. So I kind of intended on going the clinical route and then being able to have just a bigger view of what was going on in the nation to be able to be a part of that conversation, be able to do research you know, ultimately perhaps be able to manage my own practice. They don't teach you that in medical school. So I was glad to be able to sort of have a holistic understanding both, you know, of the healthcare business, of the healthcare system and healthcare policies, along with sort of a clinical background.
Gotcha.
But I decided not to go that route. I fell in love with health policy and, you know, the health system. I really found that, you know, the clinicians do a really good job. They're all really well trained. Pharmacists, clinical pharmacists, physicians, nurse practitioners, nurses, they know what they're doing. Those sciences are pretty far along. There's always work to be done, but the real problem is the system itself. So being able to actually deliver the care that can be provided by a physician to patients most efficiently, at a reasonable cost and effectively, to make sure that their care is coordinated between their different practitioners, to make sure that they're receiving the right care that they need, that's not wasteful and that's effective for their condition. So the system, I guess, has a long way to go. We know that cost is a big issue. We know that you know, the United States is far, far behind other you know, similar countries with their quality outcomes. And, you know, I saw that as a problem that I was much more interested in being involved in than going to medical school and doing a really good job for my patients. I'm interested in sort of, you know, being a part of the conversation to help a lot more patients.
Let me back up just a bit. So at Wake Forest, you took science classes there.
Right.
And then how long were you there before you went to Georgetown?
I was there for a year. So I finished my first year there.
And then if you would have taken that year and then let's say you took the management at Georgetown, could you have, if you still loved the medical more than what you were studying, could you still have reversed course? Can you take the MCATs, whatever they're called? Yep. You don't really need like a defined bachelor's for that, right? You just have to have enough to pass it? Or how does that work out?
Right. So I, you take a set of science, a course set of science courses. It's typically about 2 years of chemistry, a year of biology, a year of physics. And those are sort of the prereqs for medical school.
It's not a ton. It's a year or two.
Yeah. So I actually completed pre-med. So I definitely could have gone if I chose to.
You completed that at Wake Forest.
I competed at both at Wake Forest and Georgetown. So I was able to get all those required courses done. And I could have gone if I chose to.
And then you needed a bachelor's though to get into it. And so you're like, hey, I already got this. I might as well get something that's interesting and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of people, you don't necessarily have to do a typical like biology or you know, human science major to be able to go to medical school. There's a lot of people who apply from a lot of different disciplines, which I think really does make a stronger, more holistic clinician. So
I agree.
Yep.
I agree. All right. So back to the question that I've interrupted you on. When you're in school, 5 to 10 years out, what are people telling you? It's like, well, Robert, you can do this and you can do that. Or you're saying yourself, I can do this and I can do that. What were those things that were on your mind at that time when you graduated? What was your thought process?
Yeah, so when I made the decision to go more of the healthcare management policy route, and I can tell you that I still don't really know what I want to do.
Join the club.
Yeah.
And I got a lot more gray hair than you do, so.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of people, I'll just tell you, a lot of people go into sort of healthcare consulting. They'll go to sort of big four consulting firms. A lot of people will go to more hospital-related functions. So they'll go to, you know, get into a practice management role or a fellowship at a hospital system. And be in that role. I know a couple people doing that. I was going to go into consulting, actually, but I got this job offer with this health tech startup. So I've always kind of I've been interested in sort of healthcare innovation and building the next great, you know, I guess technologies to be able to help patients. And so I jumped at that opportunity. And so, you know, I'm here. And so I have some friends that are in sort of more strategy consulting roles for the healthcare industry.
Gotcha.
I have a lot of friends that are actually, you know, going to nursing school. So they decided they wanted to go back to a clinical route and, apply their management work as a nurse, administrator.
Gotcha.
So, and then I have a lot of friends that are in policy roles. So, in Washington, D.C., working for trade associations and working for research institutes as well.
And how long between graduation and this job then?
This job came to me. So I was supposed to join a consulting firm in July after I graduated. And then I got this job offer slightly before that. So I'd been consulting for the company for a couple months, I should say, and a couple other digital health technology companies. And they made me a job offer. And it was a good time for me to be able to take the risk and jump at the opportunity.
For sure.
So I decided it was best for me. And it's been a great learning experience so far.
And then how long have you been in this company?
About 8 months.
8 months.
Yep.
A lot happened in a short time there.
Oh, definitely. Yep. I was before I joined this company and before I was supposed to go to the consulting firm, I was working for the Institute for Medicaid Innovation. It's a nonprofit research institute that works with the Medicaid health plans across the country. So all the big names you can think of that have Medicaid health plans, we did research for them and with them.
And that was sort of while you were finishing school, basically?
Yep. That was while I was finishing school. And then a little bit afterwards, I was finishing up some policy and issue briefs on high-risk care coordination and social determinants of health data collection as well. Yep.
Tell me about your personal branding, because when I look at your information on the internet, I'm seeing stuff like your little bit of consulting, little bit of speaking. I'm seeing a book in the works and so on.
Yep.
That kind of shouts to me in a great way, kind of a personal branding. And was that sort of in preparation for I'm going to be graduating and I got to get kind of my name out to the world? Or is that a current pursuit on top of where you are now?
Yeah, I would say it's what you're seeing a lot of is just my genuine, true interest in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I It's something I'm very, very interested in. I spend a lot of time doing it. I do have a book that's been approved for publishing at New Degree Press. It'll be coming out in April 2020. It's about the intersection of sort of payment reform and health technology. So it's kind of during my time studying healthcare, I've seen that the policy people who are working on payment reform and then the technology people are not often in the same room together. So it really brings together those two, you know, big drivers of change and transformation in the country's healthcare system. Yeah. But the branding is I would say mostly a reflection of my just I've done a lot of things because I'm just interested in healthcare.
That's great.
But, you know, I have a really big passion for it. When I was a sophomore in high school, I lost my mom to chronic myeloid leukemia.
I'm sorry. That's where your speaking and fundraising comes in for that. I was going to ask you about that. My sympathies.
Thank you. It was the best, you know, educational experience of the healthcare system. So, you know, I was really in and out of clinics and inpatient units with her, managing, you know, 15 to 20 medications at a time on a daily basis. And, you know, it was an extremely difficult situation, but it's now a big driver for, you know, knowing very concretely, having experienced it, what we can do in the health system to really improve both care and the experience for patients as they navigate through their different healthcare providers.
I've always said that the smartest people that walk into our pharmacy are people that have either used a drug for a reason. If someone's, you know, on Accutane for acne, or they need something for something else, or their family members on, and it's like they know a ton more than me or the doctors, just because their heart has to be down into it.
Yeah,
you know, it seems.
Yep, absolutely. So everything that I do, you know, from that point on, was really related to, you know, getting to a position where I can learn as much as I can about the current system, and then being able to, you know, just have conversations and start working towards being able to improve a lot of the issues that come from patients that are seriously sick and have difficulty, you know, navigating the health system, managing conditions, and now with my current role, managing their medications.
Right.
So that's kind of the I guess what you're seeing as well in some of my online presence.
To me, like the three legs of the stool that I'm hearing from you would be your current product, and then the payers of medicine and so on, and then I guess the government, the policies and Medicaid and Medicare and so on. I know you've had quite a bit of interaction, it seems, with those three. Do any of those then end up somehow in this company or your product that you're doing? Is that somehow, do those morph into making a dent on all three? Or is that something that, no, yours is, your product is more off on its own as just a very good product for non-adherence?
So it really does fit in all three of those areas. So we have the current product, which is a digital health product. It's the technology, it's the information system. We have the payment, the payer side, be it government payers, Medicare, Medicaid, or sort of the private insurance companies. And then, you know, this really does affect sort of the larger policy conversation as well. And I'll kind of walk through that a little bit. So,
yeah, let's go through that.
We know that, you know, the big drivers of cost in the U.S. healthcare system, 75% of cost come from chronic diseases like diabetes, like congestive heart failure, other heart diseases, asthma. These are the things that cause people to, have a lot of prescriptions because they take, you know, medications daily to manage these chronic conditions. And we know that, you know, if not managed properly, they end up going to the emergency department, which is extremely expensive. We know they end up going to the inpatient units, which, you know, being hospitalized is extremely expensive. And we know that going to have to see specialists when something goes wrong is extremely expensive. So those are the big drivers of that 75% of cost to the U.S. healthcare system.
Sure.
$1 in $4 on the most recent estimates I've seen is spent on diabetes-related care. And so the way that our app really fits into this situation and the reason why non-adherence is important is that when patients aren't adherent to their medications, then they're not managing their conditions and they're at higher risk for deterioration. So then they're at higher risk to end up in the emergency department, end up being hospitalized, or end up having to see more specialist visits. And so, you know, that big medication adherence problem is estimated to be a $300 billion problem to the U.S. healthcare system in direct costs. So being able to, you know, make a dent in that really does help the overall healthcare system from a large government policy perspective. And then the ultimate goal is, you know, keeping people healthy. So, you know, we definitely are able, if we're able to prevent some of these costly points of care, then, you know, it's good for the health insurance companies, it's good for the government payers, it's good for, hypothetically, if that savings gets passed on to patients with, you know, lower premiums, then that's great. But, you know, we also like to think about the fact that, you know, we're helping patients maintain their health, being able to get to, you know, a child's wedding, being able to, you know, have a couple more years to see a grandchild, being able to have a better quality of life during years where people are typically sicker, simply through just making sure that patients take their medications that we know really does drive these outcomes. We know that it keeps people healthier. And so that's kind of where the technology fits in, being able to take the mobile app and then build a larger product where we're able to feed this real-time data, the patient's medication adherence percentage, their real-time medication lists into physicians' offices, into hospitals, and into insurance company care managers, so that they can see, hey, this patient's not taking their meds right now. We should give them a phone call. We should send them to a doctor. We should send somebody out to their house even to make sure that they're receiving, that they don't have any problems or they're able to get back on track with their medications. And there's a really good return on investment for that, for companies to be able to invest in technologies where instead of waiting for a patient to end up at the ER to end up, you know, starting to get sick or with a condition, they're able to be more proactive about that. And this is what sort of the core focus of my book is, actually. It's the technology provides the data and insights to the system, to the physicians, to the clinicians, to be able to do this more effectively. To be able to do it right now as opposed to, picking something up at a yearly physical when it might be too late. When somebody ends up at the emergency department, it's too late to get them to take their medications again. They're already sick. That is sort of the core focus of our product. It's providing real-time data and insights to really amplify and enhance what the health system can do already. So we're not a silver bullet. We're not here to solve the full medication adherence problem. We're really here to, A, help patients have reminders on their phone. And then in the event that, you know, there is a problem, they're not using it properly, or they're not taking their medications, or they report, they self-report that they have some symptoms that are worrisome or they're not doing too well, then the health system can step in to support them. And that's the ultimate goal here. We know we don't want any sort of big brother. This is not, we're not trying to be like sort of a big privacy issue here, which is, you know, a big hot topic in healthcare data, but it's really to provide clinicians, trusted clinicians, with the information to be able to support patients that, you know, have difficulty with taking their medications or who may start to deteriorate ahead of time. So that's sort of where medicine and the health system is going. One company that's working towards that right now. One of the big trends is telehealth. So being able to have a physician do a video chat and, you know, have an office visit like that is a big trend. But being able to have that data about patient health, their self-reported health status, and their medication adherence, which we know are really big predictors of deterioration or predictors of likelihood to go to the emergency department or inpatient units too.
Now, so where does the money come into that? You're solving a problem. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of places the money doesn't come yet, but where in theory does the money come from, or where is it going to come from?
For our company, we are focused on a couple different sectors of the healthcare system. One is sort of government payers, so Medicare, fee-for-service, and state Medicaid programs. Where we can, you know, actually sell the product to the government payers, and they can promote using that amongst those beneficiaries or people who are eligible for those programs, and then, you know, that's a federal contracts, and we're able to provide the technology to those systems to be able to use. We're also looking at health insurance companies as well, so managed care, both Medicare Advantage plans and Medicaid managed care companies, which are all the big name insurance companies that you're aware of. They're just working in these specific programs. They have whole offices full of nurses and social workers that actually reach out to their high-risk patients and try and coordinate their care. So they make sure they're filling their prescriptions. They make sure that their primary care doctor knows that they saw a cardiologist last week. They make sure that they have transportation to their office visits, because they know that if patients get the right care at the right time, then they're not going to end up paying for these really costly points of care like the emergency room and hospitalizations.
How do you survive in the meantime? Because right now you've got a great product in DoseCast.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it's free, which a lot of them are.
Yep.
And so how are you funded now? Mm-hmm. And then when does that transition happen?
We have a freemium model on the app stores, so you can download it for free, but there's certain features that you can upgrade.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
Actually pay for, so it's $2.99 a month. Sort of one revenue stream on the sort of consumer side.
Explain that to the listeners when you say freemium. Explain what they mean.
There's a couple different ways that it works. People have definitely experienced this if you have a smartphone, but you download the app for free and you have access to some features, some core features, mm-hmm. so that you can keep using it. So some companies will run ads on the free version. That'll be how they sort of fund that. But for our app, one of our main features is something called Cloud Sync. So if you want access to Cloud Sync, you have to pay $2.99 a month. But
gotcha.
What it does is it lets you remotely monitor a family member. So I can monitor my grandma who lives in Delaware, who takes a couple of medications, and I'm able to see that she took her medications today or go through there from my own device. And so those types of features are available for an upgrade cost, essentially.
That's huge. Let me back up a little bit, because right now I still own my own pharmacy, but some year I may not. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to myself, what would I do? What could I really get paid for right out of the chute? And I was talking to my wife and one of my kids, and I thought, one thing I could get paid for is going to doctor's appointments with elderly people, just driving them, being there, listening to the doctor, and then setting up their medicine, kind of keeping track of it, and reporting then to a family member who's maybe a son or a daughter 100 miles away, who maybe comes in once every couple weeks to see their mom or dad. But every time they're coming in, they're not having to see this hurricane of medicine all over the place because they weren't taking it right, and of course not getting the right benefit. So I guess I've just been replaced by your product. So now I got to find something else.
So
no, but that's a great thing.
What's really interesting, Mike, is that there's a lot of investment right now in direct to consumer pharmacist consults. And so, this might be something you could do afterwards, but, there's a couple companies right now that are, that partner with physicians' offices, and they do over the phone pharmacy consultations. Medication therapy management is how they can get reimbursed for it through Medicare. It really does help, patients improve outcomes and reduce their pharmacy costs, and it helps them sort of manage their complex medication regimens.
I had a guest on last week. He said there's like basically Uber for pharmacists or doctors, where this company through the phone is putting together, just like a driver and a passenger, they're putting together a healthcare worker and a patient who needs it, but it's an Uber-ish model.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but the next thing that is happening in the industry, and I think this is one of the most fascinating things. So when I was in the hospital with my mom, one of the things that was really revealing was the fact that when the oncologist was doing rounds, there was a clinical oncology pharmacist with him. The amount of meds that have come out in the past, 10, 20 years, has far surpassed what physicians are able to really learn. So pharmacy, sure. You know, and I'm sure you're very aware of this, Mike, but the clinical pharmacists have become, you know, its own medical specialty to be able to manage medications. So it's becoming so complicated that A, there's a market for helping physicians in private practice be able to kind of have this consultation ability, but also directly to patients who might see, and one of the core issues of the healthcare system is this fragmentation where, you know, you go to a private cardiologist, you go to a private endocrinologist, and they prescribe different meds, but they don't know what the other one prescribed. And so, you know, having that central pharmacist in there and that central authority to be able to review the whole lists that the patient's taking and say, hey, these two drugs can't be taken together. They're contraindicated. So, you know, that's something that we know is a huge problem. And even I experienced this when I was going through the experience with my mom during her treatment. You know, she was on a leukemia medication that it's called a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And, her gastroenterologist she was seeing at the time prescribed a medication that actually affects the efficacy of the leukemia drug, which is like really the biggest issue that we're dealing with. So, you know, he didn't know that, you know, she was on this drug and they were contraindicated. And so I checked all the med lists after things were prescribed and I found this contraindication. I called Pfizer, and talked to them on the phone. And I called the pharmacist at the oncology clinic and I was like, look, these two drugs can't be taken together. We got to figure out what we can do with this. And they were like, yeah, do not give her that drug. And so for patients, you know, I have a little bit of a clinical background. I was an EMT, a certified EMT for 3 years. Not a great clinical background, but, you know, enough. Yeah. And I worked in an oncology lab for about a year and a half. And so, you know, I work in healthcare. I kind of understand these things a little bit better. But for most patients who don't even know to look for that, you know, I there's a lot of bad outcomes that can occur. So, this is a really important space to be innovating in. And so pharmacist consultations can really improve safety and can really improve clinical outcomes, for the health system as a whole. Also it can reduce costs for patients too.
The pharmacists, like it or not, the pharmacists as dispensers, there's going to be better ways to do that, whether it's, you know, physically with the medicine, whether it's drones or, you know, vending machines and so on. And why not? Let's get rid of that. Then the second one would be, though, information. And there is a lot of information, more information than any of us can do on our head. And that's from their handheld, their phone that they're getting that from. So that's out. But I think the key is the word that you used is, well, let's figure this out. You know, you came, Robert, and you from practically maybe not back then, but now on your phone, you're finding out that these two meds don't go together.
Yep.
Where the expertise comes in, where the value comes in, is in that keyword. All right, well, we know this. Who's going to figure this out?
Yeah.
Who's going to find an answer to this? We've got the drug. You know, we got that from the robot. We've got the information. How are we going to figure this out? Now, down the road, maybe 10 or 20 years, it's AI that might be doing a better job figuring this out.
Right.
But right now, that figuring out part is not there. And that's where I think that pharmacists have to do their job. But the great things that your company is doing is giving enough information to allow the experts to then figure that out instead of a junior in high school being having to sit there and tell the doctor there's a drug interaction.
The thing is like, you know, being able to provide that real-time information to the people who are experts in the specific space is what needs to happen. And, you know, in my book, I really focus on, you know, I distinguish between the institution of medicine, which a lot of people view as the healthcare system. Medicine is the research and the physicians and the nurse practitioners and the nurses, and they have really developed a good understanding of the human body, how to treat diseases in the human body. But the healthcare system itself, which is where I kind of see, you know, my education, healthcare management and policy, needs to do a better job of actually delivering that expertise in an efficient and, you know, logical way to improve patient care. So, you know, the different cardiologists and endocrinologists who have different offices across the city who are caring for one patient is not a good way to make sure that that patient is receiving holistic care. And so the system, and through technology, and then through payment incentives, needs to be able to, you know, really coordinate that better, provide the information to the people that need the information at the right time. And that's
at the
sort
right
of
time.
Where,
yeah.
where things are going. That's how we at Montuno kind of see ourselves fitting into sort of the larger healthcare ecosystem. We're actually in the process of working through a tech build to be able to start offering pharmacist consultations to patients through their mobile device. So we're in the process of working through that process. You know, we also submitted a grant to the National Institutes on Aging at National Institutes of Health here to be able to develop our artificial intelligence and machine learning into to take leverage our mobile medication adherence data and some of our self-reported health data to be able to predict patient deterioration, to be able to predict medication non-adherence,
sure.
and to be able to look at the drug interactions more holistically. So we work with the director of a polypharmacy center at the University of Louisville, and we are working on sort of developing that, assuming the grant comes through. So we have a lot of big plans in the works to be able to really provide that information, not using the information as a silver bullet, like I said, but to really connect the health system, the expertise that exists, and provide them with the information they need to be able to really care for patients right now, as opposed to, like I said, waiting until, you know, we're dealing with people when they're sick. We want to reach out as soon as possible to be able to try and get the best outcomes.
Yeah, or coming in like you see in the news a few days later when they have they call the sheriff for a checkup or something like that. They found someone that's been dead for 3 days and that kind of stuff hopefully will be monitored and found out, you know, well before that, not just days, but months before that of something happening. My dad used to get so pissed off when he had cancer and ended up passing from that. And after he had bone cancer, it would affect his brain because it would swell up, different things in his brain would swell up. He couldn't think as straight, but he would get so mad because he said, "I just told that to the last doctor," you know, because every time they come in, they got a guy who can't remember stuff and they're asking him his age and his all that kind of stuff, you know, and sometimes they say they do that because they're testing and they want to see that they agree with all that stuff. But I think that's part of an excuse for just saying we don't have it all. I know Google was just in the news yesterday because I remember years ago, like 10 years ago, they had that Google Health or something they were trying to come out with. And then just yesterday in the paper, they got, I didn't read the or paper, I'm dating myself. Yesterday on the phone, they came out and they said they had a little bit of monkey business going on, coming up with some data that they maybe weren't supposed to have or something like that.
We track the digital health world pretty closely. Also, sorry to hear about your dad. But yeah, I mean, it's when I'll kind of address two points in that.
Yeah.
One is, you know, when there's a lot of pressure on physicians to see a whole bunch of patients in a day, from hospital administrators and from, you know, just in general to try and, you know, make a profit, it's kind of conceptually makes sense that they're not going to be able to really focus in on a single patient's case as much as they need to.
Sure.
So being able to simplify and provide the right actionable information to those physicians to be able to have that at their fingertips is necessary to really make sure patients are getting the right amount of care and the right amount of attention.
Right.
And so we can automate a lot of those processes using technology. We can do a lot of analysis automatically. So the physician doesn't have to sit there and go through their electronic health records so much.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot of companies working on that. And then Google, you know, there's a lot of interest in health from Google and Amazon. And, you know, a lot of large big tech companies. Facebook just came out with sort of a consumer health app, consumer health product as well. And, you know, Google signed a deal with Ascension. They're one of the largest Catholic systems in the country. They deliver care to a lot of people. It's a typical agreement that occurs with tech companies from hospitals to be able to have access to their clinical data. There's a lot of small companies like mine that run analytics on electronic health records and pull out actionable insights. to be able to, you know, risk adjust patients and be like, this patient's more priority than this patient, and a whole bunch of different functionalities. So the agreement that they signed, a business associates agreement for, you know, health data, is pretty common in the industry. Google's getting a lot of, you know, there's the privacy talk in Washington, at least, about tech privacy and who owns your data is huge right now. And so there's a little bit of a firestorm coming out with Google getting the information from Ascension. But, you know, from our perspective, obviously, patient privacy and data protection is really important to make sure that patients trust their care providers and trust the health system. And it's just, you know, it is their right to have, you know, their personal data secure and private if they choose to. But the innovation from the tech side from a big company like Google is a good thing in my from my perspective. Yeah. You know, they have access to tons of money and tons of capital. They have access to world leading experts. And so, you know, being able to really innovate in healthcare is going to come from companies like that. There's small companies that can do things quickly and like ours, but, you know, the big companies are really going to be able to do something that diffuses across the industry pretty quickly.
I agree. And at our pharmacy, I mean, we were HIPAA at our pharmacy before HIPAA was invented. I mean, when I was there, when I was 13 at this store, you know, you're not going to call up someone's friend and tell them they have this disease, or send a postcard that says, hey, do you need help with your hemorrhoid? You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. We knew that before. We're smart enough.
Yeah.
So HIPAA came in and made all this stuff official. I heard someone say everybody was afraid of, like, Big Brother. And now someone says, hey, Big Brother, should I wear my rain boots today or not?
Yeah.
You know, it's like... So I have to say this for my customers that might be listening. Yes, I'm all for privacy and so on. However, with that said, it's like, I don't have anything to hide. You know, if people want to take pictures of me to keep me in line, or if they want to know my weight or my what medicine I'm on, I'm probably not in anything too embarrassing or have a disease that maybe leaves a bad connotation of who I am. But it's like, bring it on, you know, show me the right ads, show me the right stuff. And again, I'm for privacy, but I'm for the privacy. But personally, I think if anybody knows something about me, I'm going to get more refined results and probably get better healthcare because of it, I guess.
I think it's a matter of, and you know, this is a big debate here in DC. You can't walk into a coffee shop without hearing somebody talk about it.
That's what I was saying about DC. You're in the right space, at least, to hear all those conversations going on.
Absolutely. You can just sit around and listen, and you never know what you're going to hear.
Right.
But, you know, I think that, you know, patients have a complete right to be able to require privacy. But, you know, generally speaking, a lot of people, you know, and what we've seen in some of the research and what, you know, a lot of us believe in the space is that a lot of people are like, if this gets me better care and it takes care of me better, or if I get a better service out of this, that's okay with me. It's just who has access to it. Do I have control over it if I want to? And, you know, as long as I'm getting a benefit from it, then that's okay. And I think that we're seeing sort of a trend with that. We see we look at a lot of research for, like, sort of digital engagement on smartphones and tablets with seniors in particular, people that we would expect to be really against data, to be really against tech. And we know that there's a gap between, you know, they really want to be engaged by the healthcare system on their own time, on healthcare, on their mobile devices, to be engaged digitally because it's more convenient and it doesn't disrupt life as much. And so we think that there's a pretty good market for telehealth and for technology in the older generation, who typically has a higher rate of disease, who typically take more medications. We expect that there is a market there. It's just a matter of making the applications user friendly and getting the word out. And so we think that there's a lot of benefit for that. And we know that, you know, my generation in particular, I have an Apple Watch on right now. If my doctor wants to be checking my EKG automatically on my app, or ECG, that's the German way to do it, the ECG on my Apple Watch, or they want to check my heart rate, and if something goes wrong, if they want to send me a text message and say, hi, Robert, I noticed something wrong on your ECG, you know, do you want to come in next week? If that's going to catch me a problem and keep me out of the hospital, I'm personally okay with that. And so it's just a matter of making sure that from a federal perspective that the laws and the regulations are in place to make sure that people or in large companies aren't allowed to do bad things with the data.
Well, so, yeah. And I think I agree. And I think the other thing I suppose has to do with maybe some hiring and firing laws, because there's still stigmas. And for example, I'm not sure where the – well, let's pick two. Let's say the president of the United States and let's say airline pilots. I'm not sure where the laws stand right now or where even the corporate procedures are. Are those pilots allowed to say that they're anxious and depressed and they're on a SSRI, Prozac or something?
Right.
And is a president allowed to say that he's on a Xanax when he finds out that the bunker raid is going to go on against Iraq or something that day? And I forget where some of the stuff is on that, but it seems like if there was no shame or legal ability to come down on someone like that, I think everybody's healthier to say, like, if I knew the president was doing something like that, I'd say, well, geez, that's a great lesson for somebody else.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of debate that still has to occur, which is, you know, most people will think that's all that happens in Washington. Which is a valid concern. I think that, you know, when it comes to privacy, you know, we have HIPAA, which protects personal health information and a lot more. But I think that the sharing of personal health information is less the problem. I think it's we certainly need more explicit laws in place and policies in place that prevent discrimination based on health status or health information, that prevents any sort of retribution for that. And so once those are in place, you know, in more concrete and more explicit language, then, you know, the privacy may become less of an issue. I think that, you know, obviously, for example, with Ascension and Google, the business associates agreements that are typically signed for healthcare data are, you know, you can only use this for reasons that improve clinical care. You cannot share this outside of your organization. These people have access to it. They're really explicit. The trust issue and the reason why this seems like it's a big problem is because Google, the big concern is, you know, they have a culture there where it's like, we will just do anything to innovate and, you know, break the rules. And they're concerned about sort of the internal controls and whatnot. But, you know, from a privacy perspective with personal health information, the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, they handle a lot of the HIPAA compliance issues. And, you know, in health companies, you go through a week of HIPAA training when you start, which is terribly boring after the sixth time you've heard it. But, you know, if people or if companies and people do actually slip up with personal health information, then there are consequences for that. And so you might say that they're not strong enough, or they're not, you know, patients didn't provide consent for Ascension to share that information with Google, which is one of the big topics of discussion. Like, patients can consent to share their data if they choose to. But, you know, we'll have to see where the discussion goes on this and what sort of policies come out. In Congress, it's gotten a lot of attention recently, the federal agencies are very aware. I was actually taught in my health law class by one of the inspector generals or assistant inspector generals of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General, who investigates issues with, like, fraud, waste, and abuse in the Medicare program and HIPAA-related issues as well. And so, you know, they have a really strong, robust ability to regulate and to bring consequences and, you know, levy fines if organizations do fail to protect patient data. You know, obviously more can be done, but, you know, I think a lot of the health data is pretty well protected based on what I've seen. You know, there's been some breaches, but, you know, the big concern, I think, is the larger data picture of consumer data, with Facebook having so much information and who owns it.
Right.
And that's kind of spilling over into healthcare a little bit, too.
You
know, in my experience, it's pretty well guarded.
I think so. I think it's pretty well guarded. And I guess I'm not in the position where I can't think of a disease right now that I would have or a medical thing that would prevent me from doing what I do. I suppose there's things out there. I don't know the rules. Like, if you're I'll go back to an airline pilot. They find out your sight's going bad or something in your eye, or you got a cataract or something. What does that do for your job and those kind of things?
Yeah. as a person who flies, I would certainly prefer if my pilot can see.
I would too.
Generally, I think that those types of things are important. I think that, you know, one of the big areas, just to give you a concrete example with some of the data privacy and discrimination, is like if pregnant women, if somebody is pregnant and employment, you know, they might go out on maternity leave and there's an opportunity for them to be discriminated against in the workplace there. So that's an example. I think that people who may be of higher risk for healthcare costs, who have a genetic history or some sort of disease, if their employer finds out about that and they have an employer health insurance plan, you know, they may not want to hire that person because it's going to drive up some of their costs for their insurance plan.
Yeah, those are very real life examples.
Yeah, so there is risk there. I do think that there's ways that you know, we can use regulation, we can use policy to really, you know, protect people from that type of discrimination without really preventing the innovation that needs to occur with patient data. And, you know, being able, and this is the example I always give, when you go see your doctor and you want to get diagnosed with something, they may have seen 5,000 cases in their lifetime of your condition if it's an older doctor.
Right.
But why not have a computer compare your profile and your patient data against a million patients that have had a similar condition to you, and then determine, hey, this is most likely the condition that you have based on a million. So it can really enhance the health system with that data. So, you know, that's one area I think we want to be careful with putting too much regulation on it. We want to protect patients' privacy, and we want to protect people from discrimination based on healthcare and certainly other factors as well. But we also don't want to stymie the innovation to be able to truly improve our healthcare.
And I think, like you said, Robert, I think I heard this, that it may not be so much of the HIPAA information, because we do a good job on that, but it's the discrimination. And when you had mentioned that the baby, you know, I was just thinking that the same lady that maybe doesn't want the word out to their boss for sure, because she's going to get discriminated against.
Yeah.
5 seconds later has just posted to, you know, 5,000 people on Facebook that she's having a baby. Yeah. So it's like, it's probably less of that information, more of like what can be done with it. Cause the information seems to be out there anyways. You had mentioned maybe a doctor who has so many patients, but could see, see more. And that's one of the reasons that I heard is so cool about these self-driving cars.
Right.
And now that there's LG5 or whatever out there, you know, real quick computers. But they said that, well, I'll just use this example. You're backing up a driveway with a certain slope to it, and you make a turn, but you slide a little bit into your mailbox. You know, the next winter, you might say, I remember that I went down here and slid into the mailbox. So this time I'm going to take a little bit wider angle.
Yeah.
But with the new technology and the artificial intelligence, it's like when this happens to you the first time, a billion cars are going to know the next day not to take that angle, or it could slide into the mailbox kind of thing. Yeah. So it's just, it's on that same thing as a health. It's just like so much learning that that can come from it.
Yeah. And that's what we're hoping from Google. You know, they're the experts at information and big information.
Big information.
And being able to pull it all together, big data, massive data sets, to be able to analyze it and pull out really easy, actionable information for what you're looking for. And that's what, you know, they've announced recently. They've done some hiring in their Google Health division.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that came out of it that a lot of people have said is really underwhelming is improving searches in electronic health records for physicians to be able to search. And, you know, while it seems like a pretty trivial thing, it's very complicated because there's a lot of data points and a lot of data. So, you know, I expect that to be pretty effective. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll be able to start seeing that, you know, the electronic health records are a huge topic of discussion. Physicians generally don't like them. And they have a lot of room to be improved.
I'm not a huge user right now of voice technology because I've got this $100 Google thing in my kitchen, and all I've asked it so far is what's the temperature going to be tomorrow? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I haven't delved into it, but they were talking about, like, let's say Alexa or Google Home or whatever, but they talked about having one of those in the patient's room, let's say. Mm-hmm. So a doctor's making rounds. They come into the room and the doctor doesn't want to mess with the phone and this and that.
Yeah.
And there's nurses around and everybody and the patient's there. But the doctor, with his voice, is able to get a fingerprint access of his voice. And he says something as simple as, when was the last time that Mrs. Smith had her legs looked at, you know, whatever, something very minor that would be kind of hard to search. But by having him get that information, he can say, oh, well, I'm seeing a bump here. Well, whatever the example is.
Yeah.
But a very, very, very seemingly simple question that the doctor can verbally ask. It comes back to him through the speaker or even an earpiece. And that information is worth the life or death for this patient. And they were talking about Alexa for that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, so let's take Alexa as an example here. I have an Alexa. I love my Alexa.
You do? Do you ask anything more than what you should wear today?
Well, so, you know, I'll tell you a couple of things I use on it, and then I'll give you sort of three examples of voice technology in healthcare. But I personally really like the scheduling.
Sure.
So I can be like, Alexa, remind me, you know, tomorrow at 5 that I need to do this, and she'll text me. And you know, that's great for my calendar.
Yeah.
I like to ask about the weather in the morning before I go outside. You know, they're simple things, but they fit nicely into your life. And one of the things I recently discovered is if you're a Prime member and you go to Whole Foods, and you pick up a like one of their prepackaged, you know, meals that you can make, pre-portioned, like Blue Apron or HelloFresh, right?
Sure.
You can take it home and Alexa will walk you through the steps.
Oh, is that right?
So I can be like, Alexa, I have, you know, the honey orange chicken today.
Yes.
Can you walk me through the steps? And Alexa will be like, sure. Step one, start chopping the cucumber.
Yeah.
And so like, that's an interesting piece.
Yeah.
So I do like my Alexa quite a bit. And so here's three like quick healthcare things, right? So one, we're working on voice technology for, you know, monitoring patients in the home. So for seniors, it's hard for them to use the mobile device. So, you know, when we want to ask them, you know, how are you feeling today? Tell us a little about your health. They can speak it and we can have that data sent to their physician.
Exactly.
So that's one. So I think the two overarching categories are improving sort of the physician-patient experience. So physicians right now really rail against electronic health records because they sit in the office and they have to sit there and type while they're talking to their patient.
Exactly.
Patients don't like it. But now I can face patient and I can be like, I see I'm doing a, you know, I'm doing an eye exam. I'm looking through here. I'm seeing a little bit of occlusion.
Yeah.
I'm going through here. I'm doing a, you know, a knee exam.
Yeah.
Reflexes look great. And that information can then be taken through voice and structured into an electronic health record format.
Maybe even someday it's like how Microsoft did this. They watch people's movements to do the games, you know, like playing ping pong and stuff. And maybe they say, well, when the doctor bends over at this angle and brings both hands up, we're going to record that he looked at the eye or something like that. But same idea, though. Okay. So, the doctor can talk it through.
Yeah. And so hopefully then we're able to pull that and do an electronic health record.
Yeah.
And then that improves the patient physician experience, improves the patient's experience, and we're getting that data that we need, that really rich data.
Right.
So that's kind of a hope, I think, that might be effective moving forward. And then there's, I think the big one, though, is patient data collection in the home. So giving patients the ability to schedule some of their healthcare stuff through Alexa and being able to collect healthcare related data through Alexa, I think is truly the future. So, you know, once a day, Alexa asks you, how are you feeling today?
Yeah.
If you say, oh, I have a headache and my chest hurts a little bit and it's been sweaty all day.
Yeah.
I haven't taken my nitroglycerin for my heart condition for a couple of days because the prescription didn't get filled. And then, you know, that's an alert that might say, hey, this patient might be having maybe at risk for a heart attack coming up. And so, you know, or whatever the questions need to be or whatever gets pulled out of there. And then, you know, clinician, nurse can call and be like, hey, you're at risk. Or Alexa can even say, hey, you might be at risk. You should call your doctor.
Yeah.
And that's the type of thing that can really help the healthcare system sort of become more proactive rather than, again, waiting to schedule appointments after a patient ends up in the emergency room.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that that's a big thing.
Yeah, and it's not asking things like, tell us your temperature and your blood reading. It's saying, are you feeling like you've been sweating a little? You know, whatever they can put into words. But then the smarts of the internets, you know, they, as they say, puts it together and gives them something for it. Robert, what is your day like in general? Are you on the phone? Are you at a computer? Are you in meetings? What are you doing like generally through the day? Where's your body taking you through the day kind of physically on things?
Yeah, so I sit at a computer a lot. I'm at an early stage startup. And just to answer your question earlier on the funding, it was built and then there was success. So there was a capital to keep operating since 2010. The application was sold to some big healthcare systems and some bigger organizations as well.
Good.
There was a recent cash infusion this past year. So I was able to come on board and start working full time.
When they sell, I imagine they give them more access to the... freemium and so on. And that was part of my question. Well, if it's free for everybody, why have someone buy it? But they give them more functions and it's tied in more and all that stuff, I imagine.
Yeah. So the health insurance companies or the home health agencies or the health systems will purchase it and they'll pay a monthly, it's a SaaS model, a software as a service. So they'll pay a monthly fee for that and they can offer it to any number of patients that they want to have using the functionality. And so that's sort of the business model there. What I do on a day-to-day basis, I do a lot of research on sort of other products. I do research on sort of health industry trends, and then I do some sales. So I'm on the phone. I'm talking to potential customers and clients. I do a lot of talking with some of our partners that go in on federal grants with us. So I, for the months of September and October, I was writing a lot of of grants and a lot of contract proposals for federal government. And so it's a mix. I wear a lot of hats and, it's been a great experience so far. The application's actually been in some clinical studies, one out of the University of Utah. And so they use it in, young adults with cancer, population. And so they wanted to see if a mobile smartphone application that can help patients remember their medications would be accepted by that age group. And they think it was helpful. The study did show that the people that were included in the study, they really did find value in it. It did help them remember their medications. They did use the app. So the tool is clinically validated. We're looking to get into some more, rigorous academic evaluations of the product going forward.
How many people are you with every day? Are there a couple of you? Are there a handful of you? Are there more? Yeah. How many people are running around the office during the day?
So there's a few of us. Some of us work from home every once in a while. And so we have a kind of a shared office space like a WeWork. I meet with our CEO. We have a development team that works on the application that we work with. And then, I see a lot of other companies in the office as well. So it's a shared workspace, like I said.
Yeah.
So there's policy, there's nonprofit, there's other consultants that are here too. So it's a pretty busy office, but we're located at a new development in Washington D.C. called the Wharf. So it's right on the water. Beautiful office space. I probably say I split my time 50-50 office, work from home, but I do a lot of phone calls, I do a lot of networking, I go to a lot of meetings with potential customers and potential collaborators as well.
Yeah. With the actual app, what are you hearing are crap, Google or Apple is doing this again? What are the pain in the ass things with dealing with an actual app?
Yeah.
You know, it's like... One question I always have is, how long does it take? If you found a problem on your app, how long would it take to, let's not say the fixing part, that could take a long time. But let's say once you fix something and put it back into we have a new version because we found out this something was broken. How long does it take before the customer can upload that?
There's frequent the app stores, so both Google, Amazon, and Apple. they all require frequent updates. So you can't just write code for a mobile application and then just stick it on to the App Store and then expect it to remain on the App Store. So you have to manage it and continually improve it. Okay. And so it's a frequent, you have to do it so frequently. You know, with any technology, there's going to be some bugs that pop up for some users. Yeah. And so you get data when Apple, I recently learned this, when Apple asks you, do you want to share this data with Microsoft? Do you want to share this data with Apple? Do you want to share this information with, you know, anything, your Dell to improve your product? Yeah. If you opt into that, the companies get the data and they say, oh, you know, this app is crashing. O'clock because there's a whole bunch of users on there. And so the developers, the software engineers will sit there and they'll figure out what the issue is and they'll be able to identify that and rewrite the code. And then hopefully it, you know, makes the app, it fixes the bug, and then you just push an update. So you just update the application.
And does that update rather quickly then?
Yeah.
Like if you guys found a problem right now, if you fixed it, like let's say you push the button to say, all right, this is fixed. Go back out. Would that be up like in 5 minutes or something?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a matter of rewriting the code. You typically want to warn your, in typical product management, you typically want to warn your users, hey, we're pushing an update on, you know, this day. You know, you might see some disruption, you know, please update your app to fix these bugs. So you want to be transparent about it.
But it can be done right away.
Yeah. So you just, you know, it's a matter of how big the problem is, you know, how much code has to be written to actually fix it. So, I mean, if you're a big company like Facebook, Google, like you can have, you know, your 300 software engineers working on it overnight and have it up. If it's a big problem, happen very quickly. But typically what will happen is you'll kind of rewrite the code. You'll make your fixes of your bugs and then you'll sort of, you know, upload. And I'm not a software engineer, so I could be misquoting some of this, but you typically upload that that information to, you know, basically through the console, the developer's console that Apple, Google, Amazon provide. And then the app is then pushed out and available for update on mobile devices. Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know why I thought longer. I guess I've seen some problems on some apps where, you know, like it resets when you do this. And it seems like maybe they had problems changing the code and so on. But then once it's done, they do it pretty fast.
There's any number of issues that can come up.
Cost
related. It can be, you know, somebody could not be working for you anymore, and then you have to have somebody relearn it. You never know.
For sure. A ton of reasons before that. Yeah.
Yep.
Doesn't just happen like that.
Yeah.
What's the most frustrating part? I don't mean about your company. We're not going to talk about the people that sign your check. What's the most frustrating part about your day in general or week or whatever?
Let's see here.
Dealing with anybody or
I would say for me, somebody who comes from more of a research background, who did a lot more analysis and a lot more analytics. Being in an early stage startup, you have to wear a lot of hats and you have to move kind of quickly. So, you know, just by nature of that role, you know, you don't get to sit there and spend a week developing a really deep amount of knowledge on a subject. So you really have to like do stuff as you go and stay on your feet to be able to, you know, basically stay operating. And so, you know, I will say that, you know, I do miss, you know, having some time to sit down and really do a thorough literature review and, know, understand where the research has come from something and then be able to develop a new analytic framework to evaluate a problem going forward. And then, you know, have the luxury of time and the narrowness in your job to be able to really, focus on something and really comprehensively sit there and be like, I get this now. I know what this is. I'm very confident in this. I can go speak to it. There's a lot of kind of being on your feet, which is interesting. And I do enjoy that. It's been, like I said, a great learning experience, but I definitely, you know, I do miss a little bit of having that dedicated time to really hit something really hard.
Think it through. And if it's your own problem, you can gradually do that. But if someone has asked you about it, then it's like you're on their time frame.
Yep.
Robert, if someone said you had to take a sabbatical away from your book, away from the business, what would you do for a year? And they say, we'll see you in 365 days. Your job's here. What would you be doing for that year?
It's hard to work full time and write a book. To caveat, I would say if I had time off, I would focus a little bit more on the book. But if I really had the opportunity to take time off If I had the financial ability to do it, I would travel quite a bit. I would really like to do that. But my interests really lie in research. So what I would tell you is I could go back to school. I would probably try and get some, like, a fellowship. I would get a research fellowship with a research institute and spend some time working on a specific issue.
That's a good sign. I mean, it's like you're not clawing at the walls trying to get out of what you're doing, you know? It sounds like you're on the right path.
I might start a podcast.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah, being in D.C., you have access to a lot of people. So, you know, that might be something that would be interesting to do. I've talked about it a couple times. But, you know, you only have so much time in the day, which is something I'm starting to learn a little bit more about.
You know, they say now is the time. You know, podcasts, as you know, they've been around for, you know, 10 or 15 years. They say now is the time. And I don't really believe that because it seems old to me. But then, for Pete's sake, Google just came out with their first podcast app like a half a year ago or something. So I guess it's rather new.
They're getting popular. I mean, I really like them. I'm heading back to Atlanta for Thanksgiving, and I'm purposely I'm renting a car to drive back instead of flying back to DC because I want dedicated time to listen to all the Freakonomics episodes I've missed.
Yeah, they're good.
And I'll definitely, you know, add the Business of Pharmacy on there too.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I have to bring some stuff back, which is, you know, another driving force. But, like, I'm sitting here and I'm just like, I'm very excited to have this 10 hours in the car by myself to listen to some podcasts. You know, I think that it's a big industry that's coming up. You know, I remember being in school and, you know, some of the professors actually assigning, like, do a podcast episode as an assignment. I think that this type of media is becoming more popular to really be able to, you know, actually it's more user friendly and more mobile than having to sit there and read something.
I've always thought of podcasts as like a movie, but, you know, not as good because you don't get to see it. But it really, if you compare it to reading, I had heard that, you know, there's some people that just can't read. More people can hear than read because of concentration issues and dyslexia and just having the time to sit down, and you can't read while you're in the car and those kind of things. One interesting thing that I've noticed is two or three podcasts that are the longest have the most listeners.
Interesting.
I was kind of amazed by that, and I've got a theory for it. And my theory is that we are so sick of making decisions. You know, you go in and you have a million decisions you have to make. So my theory is, if you can pick a podcast that's an hour or an hour and a half or whatever, it's only one decision. Where if you have a 10-minute podcast, you have to pick between 6 and 9 podcasts instead of just making the decision to go with one. So
yeah, I think, you know, what if you think about like 60 minutes. You know, that's been around for so long and it's really engaging. And you think about this as more of a more mobile, accessible 60 minutes where you can listen to it when you're commuting. And I really use them for educational purposes. I mean, you get to listen to interviews with people who are, you know, working in industry, or like, I like Freakonomics because it's all behavioral economics and psychologists. So it's very academic focused. And, you know, I when I get into cars, like, that's, I love sitting there listening to it.
That's your time. And on purpose, even to focus on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to keep learning. So like, I see it as not being in school, being able to stay on top of topics. They're basically, some of them are like mini lectures. I listen to a philosophy podcast with a bunch of philosophers from Oxford and Cambridge.
What's that called?
It's called Philosophy Bites.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At Georgetown, we have to take a lot of philosophy and theology. So, you know, you have a little bit of an understanding. And so it's just an interesting way to think about the world. And so, you know, I see it as they're 30, 40 minute long lectures and you can keep learning. I think that they're great. I'm a big fan.
Well, speaking of learning, Robert, I'm so glad you reached out to me to do this, because I've learned a ton on this from you, which a lot of the guests, I cleaned up my learning because I had a little bit of knowledge, but on this stuff, I had not as much. And you've really brought some really interesting stuff to this. So I'm sure the audience is going to love this. It's kind of late in the show to put a plug in on the last minute of the, of our episode here, but nonetheless, it was sure a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, Mike, I really enjoyed the opportunity. You know, it's I like to be able to talk about this type of stuff, and especially the work that we're doing at Montuno. But you know, the healthcare system in general is it touches all of our lives, and you know, it's a big topic of debate for the you know, presidential election. It's very important. You know, and pharmacy, truthfully, bringing it back to sort of, you know, the core focus of the podcast is a huge industry, both from the research and development for medications and drugs and, actually delivering it to patients. And so, you know, it's a huge part of the conversation in the greater health policy world here in Washington. And sometimes it might get missed in the sort of, you know, more public presidential debates, but, under Medicare for All, under, you know, some of these different policies that are being touted, Medicare buy-ins, fixing the Affordable Care Act, you know, all of those are going to involve alterations to pharmaceutical drug pricing and to, you know, managing pharmaceuticals better. So, I mean, extremely relevant podcast. Glad to be talking about it. It was a great discussion.
I'm always talking to my people at the store about, you know, how I never know the future of our little independent corner pharmacy. But you say the top cause of death is cancer and heart disease. You got guys like Steve Jobs that had it all, but his health.
Yeah.
If they talk about businesses being problems that you solve, and if you solve them, you get paid for them, there's always going to be a need for health discussions on a smaller level, on your bigger policy level, and how all that intersects with the technologies and payments and stuff. So I think we're on the right topics.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes down to it, and this is what I talk about in my book, is like one of the core features is like the interaction between any healthcare provider, the health system, and the patient is where the magic happens. Anything that happens in the policy arena up top can really influence that. But truthfully, if you want to improve a patient's healthcare, if you want to actually do what the healthcare system is meant to do, it comes down to where is that patient, you know, going to get their medications? Who's talking to them there? You know, and who's their physician? And, you know, when it comes down to it, the stuff that happens at the patient level is extremely important to understand and far too often gets lost in the greater conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does. And that's where you can go a long ways. But if you got some stubborn, you know, maybe I'm almost that age right now, stubborn old fool that doesn't want to open his mouth to take a medicine because he doesn't believe what his doctor's saying or this or that. That's not the 40% of the adherence of forgetfulness or whatever, but it's stubbornness, but that's another topic.
Well, it fits into the other 60%. So being stubborn, distrust, and, you know, hearing the same messaging from a physician and from a pharmacist where you pick your drugs up to, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure it has an effect on patients' willingness to trust the system a little bit more. Like if you trust your pharmacist and you don't trust your doctor, you know, your pharmacist tells you the same thing, maybe it's like, okay, well, I guess I can do this.
Yeah. Or maybe not.
Yeah.
Hey, pleasure, Robert. Thank you.
Yep. Same here, Mike.
All right. We'll talk to you again. You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.